very week in December, perhaps picking up a virus at one of those bouncy venues that Meredith despises. That the Donahues had to be out of children's cough medicine. Maybe they both forgot to pick it up earlier that day. And that Mr. Donahue had to go out precisely when he did. Perhaps he stalled a few minutes to watch news coverage of the shoe bomber, the big story that broke that day. And on and on and on. Yet, no matter how I slice it, or what other factors may have been at play on that fateful night, and in the weeks, months, and years leading up to it, the inescapable, bottom line, stone-cold truth remains. Daniel would be alive today had I not gotten drunk. No, wasted, on the night of December 22nd, 2001. Obviously, there is nothing I can do about the past except live with it. But my agonizing dilemma becomes what to do moving forward. Do I make a joint decision with Nolan to tell Meredith what really happened that night? Do I confess to Meredith on my own, regardless of what he decides? Do I tell my family the truth, simply because they deserve to know every detail of Daniel's final hours? Or will telling them only burden them with more heartache? I think about the repercussions of a confession, and worry that my father might blame himself for my excessive drinking. I can certainly see my mother feeling that way. I can also see her lamenting that she hadn't been stricter during my teenaged years. Most of all, I know beyond a doubt that a confession will only further poison my relationship with Meredith, perhaps end it altogether, and that it might also be the death knell for her marriage. I know my sister, and I just can't imagine her forgiving either one of us for keeping such an enormous secret. After several torturous days and restless nights, I decide to talk to the one person I can always trust. So I knock on Gabe's door late one evening, finally catching him alone without Leslie. "Yeah?" he calls out, sounding exhausted. I opened the door a crack and peer into his darkened room.
"Sorry, were you asleep?"
"Nah," he says, rolling from his back onto his side to look at me.
"I just got in bed. You okay?"
Yeah. I just wanted to talk."
"Well, come on in,"
he says.
I hesitate one beat, then take a deep breath, climb onto his bed, and talk as quickly as I can, before I change my mind, spilling my whole disjointed raw confession.
"Well, you always thought this might be the case,"
he says after I'm finished, his tone sympathetic, yet matter-of-fact.
"Yeah," I say, nodding as I hug my knees. "But I also always hoped I was wrong."
"I know,"
he murmurs.
"It sucks," I say.
"Yeah, but aren't you just a little relieved to know?" he asks. "Now you don't have to wonder anymore."
I nod, impressed with his usual insightfulness. "Yeah, I guess, maybe a little. I probably should have talked to Nolan a long time ago."
"He should have talked to you, too," Gabe says, loyally shifting the blame. "And I really can't believe he never told Meredith. Wow."
"Well, I kept the secret from her, too."
"Yeah, but you aren't married to her."
I nod.
"Besides," Gabe continues, "Nolan knew the truth. You only suspected it."
"I guess," I say, having considered all of these angles as I searched for ways to absolve myself, or at least mitigate my culpability. "But we're still both to blame for what happened." Gabe props himself up, cradling his head in his left hand.
"Nobody is to blame, Josie. It's not like someone was drunk driving here. It was an accident nobody could have foreseen."
"Still," I say.
"Still what?"
he says, his brow furrowed. "I still played a role in it, and I still have to tell my family. They deserve to know the truth."
I stare into Gabe's eyes, hoping he'll talk me out of it. Tell me there's no point, or at least no upside.
"Don't you agree?" I ask, holding my breath.
He hesitates, then slowly nods.
"Yeah, I think you're probably right. But I think you need to tell them for your sake, more than theirs, so that you can move on.
But I have moved on, I say, cutting him off, thinking that it is a large part of my guilt. The fact that I moved on with my life so effortlessly, never visiting my brother's grave until last week, barely even mentioning him to friends or family.
Gabe shakes his head. No, you haven't, Josie. You haven't moved on at all. You carry this with you everywhere.
I stare at him, knowing that he's right, and wondering how he can tell.
And look what it's done to you.
He finishes softly. What's it done to me? I ask, lowering my eyes, afraid of his reply, his always brutal honesty.
Well, for one, he says, you didn't tell your boyfriend why I was in your bed that night.
So? I say, bristling at the mention of Will.
So? You would rather have had him think you cheated on him than know the truth about the night your brother died. What does that tell you?
Are you saying that I should have told Will? That I could be married to him if I told him the truth about why you were in my bed? About everything? It is a thought that has occurred to me countless times over the years, and even more in the last few days.
No, Gabe replies adamant. That's not what I'm saying at all. I think if Will had been right for you, he would have believed you when you told him nothing happened with us.
Yes, but it did look pretty bad, I say, wondering why I'm still defending Will after all these years. Gabe shakes his head, his voice becoming louder, passionate.
So what? So it looked bad? Nothing happened.
Well, geez, Gabe, I know that. I tried to tell him that many, many times, I say, getting sickening flashbacks to our final few escalating fights and the lonely, empty aftermath when it slowly began to dawn on me that he wasn't coming back. Ever.
You could have done a much better job of convincing him, and you know it, if he had been your soulmate,
Gabe says, using a term I've never heard him use before.
You would have confided in him, or he would have taken your word and trusted you. You would have trusted him enough to tell him everything. Instead, you let him think the worst about you. So he did.
Killing my brother is worse than cheating on Will. Gabe cringes, dropping his head back to his pillow.
You didn't kill your brother, Joe. Don't ever say that again.
Well, it feels like I did. Do you know how many times Daniel gave me lectures about drinking? About how I needed to be more careful because of our dad? Jesus, Gabe, just a couple days before he talked to me about it, and I brushed him off.
You were a college kid, Josie. Lots of college kids drink too much.
He never did, I say. Meredith doesn't either.
Well, you're not them, he says, and you're not your father. You're you. Did you have too much to drink that night? Absolutely. Did you drink too much the other night when you made out with Pete at Johnny's?
He smiles, clearly trying to cheer me up. We didn't make out, I say, quibbling with his verb, but he raises his hand and continues.
The point is, I don't think you've ever had a drinking problem. Maybe an attitude and behavior problem, he says, smiling again, but not a drinking problem.
Well, my behavior, along with my drinking, resulted in my brother's death, I insist, whether directly or indirectly, it did. And...
And what?
And I deserved to lose Will because of it, I finished decisively, truly believing this.
As your punishment? Gabe asks.
Yes, I say, as my punishment. Gabe shakes his head.
I disagree. I strongly disagree. You and Will broke up because he wasn't right for you, Josie. That was clear. Hell, that was clear to me long before you broke up. You were never yourself around him. You were a fake Josie. And you haven't loved anyone since, Will, because you won't let yourself.
That's not true, I say, thinking of all the guys I've gone out with and slept with and tried to love and tried to make love me.
It is true. And you need to stop punishing yourself.
Gabe stares up at me with a mixture of pity and love before reaching out to gently touch my arm. The gesture, along with the feel of his skin on mine, instantly floods my eyes with tears.
Aw, Joe, don't cry, he says. Come here.
Where? I say, desperately needing a hug, even from one of the world's most awkward huggers.
Right here, he says, patting his chest twice, before pulling me down beside him,
wrapping both arms around me.
I'm so sad,
I say, as it occurs to me that we are lying together exactly the way Will found us all those years ago, and that nothing has really changed since that night.
I know, Gabe says, his breath warm in my hair. But you need to forgive yourself. It's time, Joe.
But what if my family doesn't forgive me?
They will.
But what if they don't?
I say, thinking specifically of my sister.
Well then, I'll be your family.
You mean my baby daddy? I ask, smiling, only partly kidding.
Yeah, that too, he says with a little laugh.
Are you really serious about that?
I ask. Would you really do that for me?
Of course I would, Josie. I'd do anything for you,
he says. I try to thank him and tell him that I feel the same, but can't get out the words, too overwhelmed with gratitude. Besides, I know he doesn't expect a reply, that he's simply stating a fact I already know. Instead, I close my eyes and let myself drift off in his arms, doing my best to memorize the moment I will one day tell my son or daughter about. That was the moment I made my decision. The moment I picked your father. The moment I knew.
Chapter 26. Meredith. 4 days, 2 off-Broadway plays, 1 musical, and endless hours of wandering the city later. I can't tell if I'm feeling a little better or much worse. I decide it's closer to the latter when I get a call from Josie, gushing about how cute Harper looked in her butterfly costume. Did you get my photos? Yes. Didn't I thank you? I say, knowing that I did. Yes, she says, you did. I'm really glad you stopped over to see her. Because, of course, Nolan only took one shot, and it was dark and blurry. She laughs and says, typical guy. I murmur my agreement, and a long pause ensues before Josie brings up her visit to the cemetery. Yeah, I heard y'all went, I say, tensing. How was it? It was nice, she says. Difficult, but nice. I feel a little better. Well, good. Great. Does Mom know you went? I ask, feeling certain that the answer is no. I don't think so, unless Nolan told her. I haven't mentioned it to her yet. Well, maybe you should tell her. You know, since she's been wanting you to go for years, I say. Yeah, I know, I will, she says. I actually need to talk to both of you. Oh, I say. About some things, she says. When are you coming home? I lean back on Ellen's sofa and stare at a large watermark on the ceiling as I tell her I don't know. Soon? She presses. I don't know, I say again, irritation creeping into my voice. A long silence follows, but I am determined to outlast my sister. Are you coming home? She finally asks. Now why would you ask that? I bark, enraged by her insinuation that I would abandon my child. God, sorry, she says. I didn't mean to offend you. I'm just worried about you and Nolan and Harper. Well, don't be, I say. You have your hands full with your own life. I know my response is over-the-top bitchy, and I brace myself for a brawl, or at the very least, one of her signature hang-ups. But Josie floors me by taking the high ground. You're right, Mare, I do, she says. But I'm really trying here. Trying to do what, exactly? I snap. Trying to get it together. and I just really, really want to see you in person. If you're not coming home, do you think I could come up there? I shake my head and roll my eyes, getting the sudden feeling that Josie is using my crisis to justify a trip to New York and score a free place to stay. Is it really that urgent? Yes, Mayor, she says. It kind of is, actually. I sigh, telling myself not to fall into Mom's trap and start worrying that it's something dire or health-related. Can you at least tell me the topic? I ask, betting that it involves Will, or her sperm donor guy and their half-assed birth plan, or maybe even some other new guy. Josie never going very long before some new male character emerges in her life. A long pause follows, so long that I think we've been cut off. Are you still there? I say. Yes, she says. I'm here. Okay, well, what's the topic? I ask again. It's about Daniel, she says, her voice cracking. I need to talk to you about Daniel. All of my instincts tell me to say no, that Josie is somehow manipulating me and my situation, or otherwise pulling some sort of attention-grabbing stunt. But of all the things my sister's been dramatic about over the years, our brother has never been one of them. I think back to the days immediately following the accident, how she disappeared into her room for hours on end while the rest of us milled about the kitchen. I think about her demeanor at the funeral, how self-contained and withdrawn she was. I can't recall her crying at the service at all, and have a vivid memory of her standing apart from our family at Daniel's graveside, until my grandmother pulled her over to the front row of folding chairs, practically forcing her to sit down. So on the off chance this is all legitimate, I sigh and say yes. She is welcome to come to New York this weekend. Josie's flight lands around 7 on Friday night, and she pulls up in a taxi less than an hour later, just as I'm arriving home from the corner bodega. She sees me first, calling out my name through her open cab window. She is wearing her hair wavy and natural around her unmade-up face, and my first thought is that she looks stunning. Way prettier than when she spackles on the makeup and irons all the life out of her hair. I try to wave, but my grocery bags are weighing down my arms, so I simply smile and yell hello, waiting for her to get out of the car. It takes an unusually long time for her to pay her fare and finish chatting with her driver, and I feel myself growing annoyed. She is the kind of person who will finish her phone call and touch up her lip gloss while someone waits for her spot in a packed parking lot. It makes me crazy. I tell myself to stop my mental rant, then take a deep breath. I have enough on my plate right now. A few seconds later, her door swings open, and she plants a black suede platform boot onto the street, before heaving a giant roller bag out of the back seat. Perfect timing, she declares as she gets out of the taxi, slams the door, and waves goodbye to her cabbie. Yeah, I just ran to the store. I smile brightly while eyeing her suitcase. That's a lot of luggage for two nights, I can't resist saying. I know, I'm a terrible packer. I just threw a bunch of stuff in before school this morning. She steps toward me, then throws her arms around me. It's so good to see you, Mare. I lower my plastic bags to the sidewalk and hug her back, stiffly at first. Then I relax, as I realize that in spite of my cynicism, I'm genuinely happy to see her. We separate, and I watch her glance up, then down the block, as if to get her bearings. Then she squints and points up at Ellen's building. That's it, right? Yes, fourth floor. It's a walk up, I say with a grimace. No elevator. That's okay. I need the workout, she says, making a muscle, then motioning toward my grocery bags and asking if we're eating in tonight. That hadn't been my plan, but I say yes anyway, trying to gauge her reaction. Would that be okay with you? Sure, she says, passing the test, at least for now. Whatever you want to do is cool with me. I smile, then turn and lead her up the stone steps of Ellen's building. We walk into the bare-bones lobby, past the small grid of mail slots, then enter the musty stairwell. All the while, Josie rambles about how tired she is, what a long week it's been, how exhausting it is to be a teacher, especially with young children who have no self-control or respect for your personal space. After two flights, she's completely winded, and by the third, she has to put her bag down to catch her breath. "How many pairs of shoes did you bring?" "Tell the truth," I say. I don't know, 4 or 5, she flashes me a sheepish yet somehow still proud smile. "Including the pair you're wearing?" "Okay, so 5 or 6, she says. "And yet you'd be okay staying in?" I say as we climb the last flight. "I said yes," she says. "Why do you keep asking me that?" "I only asked you twice." "Right, but I already said yes. Whatever you want is fine, Mare." "Okay," I say, rounding the corner, then unlocking Ellen's door and pushing it open. Once inside, I put my groceries down and slowly remove my boots, lining them neatly up next to the doormat, her cue to do the same. But of course she does not, sauntering right past the entryway, her filthy airplane airport city sidewalk boots clunking on the hardwood. "Hey, Josie," I say, "your shoes?" She rolls her eyes and says she was just about to take them off. Would I please give her a chance? "Okay, sorry," I say, though I don't actually believe her. "You know, it's my thing. You overpack. I obsess about germs." "I know," she says, retreating a few steps. "But still, don't you remember how Mom used to tell us to say thank you before we had a chance to spit the words out?" "Yeah," I say with a laugh. The cupcake wouldn't yet be transferred to our hands before she was like, "Girls, what do you say?" Josie sits on the floor, pulling off her boots. "Exactly. And don't you remember how much it always annoyed us? Because we were totally going to say it? Only now, we no longer got the credit for having good manners. We just look like a couple of dolts." She stands and looks at me, her brows raised. I smile, thinking, not for the first time, that although some of our worst sibling rivalry involves vying for our mother's favor, some of our best bonding has come at her expense. I carry the grocery into Ellen's tiny galley kitchen, putting away the few perishable items before washing my hands. Josie does the same, this time without prompting, then turns and eagerly asks for a tour. "Well, this is pretty much it," I say, gesturing toward the living room, plus her bedroom in the back. "It's nice," she says, walking over to the windows and looking out to the street below. "Very cute and cozy. What's the rent run?" "They bought it, and I have no idea what they paid for it," I say, despising the way Josie talks about money.
"Must be nice," she says under her breath.
"Having that kind of loot?" "Better than being broke, I guess," I say, refraining from my usual commentary about how money can't buy you happiness.
"Yeah, that's an understatement," Josie says with a laugh, picking up a little bronze Buddha from an end table.
"This is cute." I nod, thinking Ellen probably isn't going for cute. "Yeah, she has good taste."
"What would you call her style anyway?" Josie asks, putting down the Buddha and running her hand up and down the base of a lamp made of cork.
"Oh, I don't know. Eclectic? The opposite of Andy's?" She nods, then inspects Ellen's coffee table books, now in full-on nosy mode. She opens one on photography, reading the inscription from Andy, then flipping randomly to an edgy black-and-white portrait of Lenny Kravitz.
"Cool shot," she murmurs.
I nod. "Did Ellen take any of these?" she asks, still flipping through the pages.
"I don't think so, but maybe," I say, thinking that Josie seems to have such love-hate feelings about Ellen. Sort of the way I felt about Shauna in high school, both fascinated by and disdainful of her at once, which often boils down to jealousy. "She shot a few famous people."
"Oh, I know. She's told me," Josie says, rolling her eyes,
implying that Ellen brags, which couldn't be further from the truth. Does she know I'm here this weekend? I nod. Uh-huh. What did you tell her? I don't remember exactly, just that you were coming for the weekend. And? And what? Did you tell her why I was coming? I raise my eyebrows and stare at her pointedly. No. How could I do that? She gives me a blank look. I don't know why. Remember? She glances away, crossing her arms over her chest as she sits on the far end of Ellen's contemporary sofa. God, this is so uncomfortable, she says. At first, I think she's talking about the two of us, until she adds, why would she buy a sofa that's this hard? Maybe she likes it, I say. To each her own. Not possible. It's terrible. I shrug. Well, I don't think she sits around here very much. She really just works and sleeps when she's in the city. So, was she okay with me staying here? Josie asks expectantly, almost as if she wants the answer to be no. Yeah, she was totally fine with it, I say, sitting on the other end of the sofa. It is the truth, but I leave out the part about how Ellen and I analyzed the subject for nearly 30 minutes, unable to come up with any possible Daniel-related topic that would necessitate an urgent face-to-face dialogue. I doubt that, Josie mumbles. Against my better judgment, I ask her why she always thinks the worst of Ellen. I don't think the worst of her, Josie says. I like her fine. I just get the feeling she thinks the worst of me. I shake my head. That's not true, I say, because it actually isn't. She often defends you. My voice trails off. She narrows her eyes and says, oh? Why would she need to do that? My mind races for a clever retort, but I come up empty-handed. Because you drive me nuts, I say, smirking at her. That's why. Well, you drive me nuts, too, she says, with a little pout that takes a few seconds to dissipate. But I'm still really glad to see you. Me too, I say, wondering how I can have such mixed feelings, and how they can shift so quickly and radically, even from one minute to the next. So, how long do you think we can go without arguing? Jeez, she says with a little laugh. It's like you want to fight with me. I tell her that's silly, that I hate fighting with her. Me too, she says. God, we've had some doozies, haven't we? I nod, almost fondly. Remember Chick-fil-A? Of course, I laugh, conjuring the details of perhaps our most epic fight, occurring when she was 16 and I was 14. Every morning she drove me to school in our family's ancient Volvo, dropping me off at Pace before she headed the couple of miles over to Lovett. The problem, of course, was that we could never agree on our departure time, and she was always running late. She must still hold the record at Lovett for the most tardies in a school year. On that particular morning, though, Josie had promised me multiple times that she would do her best to get me to school early, as I had left my math book in my locker and needed to finish my homework. All was fine until she pulled into the Chick-fil-A on Northside, announcing that it would only take a sec to get a chicken biscuit. Incredulous, particularly after I observed the long drive-through line, I tried to talk her out of it, even resorting to begging. Too late, she said as a car pulled up behind us, trapping us in line. Sorry, Charlie. God, why do you have to be such a bitch, I said. Why do you have to be such a nerd, she replied, then went on to mock me for caring so much about my math homework. Our arguing quickly escalated as we inched along, until I went too far, making a snide comment about how she really didn't need those extra calories. As soon as the words were out, I regretted that particular brand of meanness, especially knowing how self-conscious she was about her weight, and how hard she'd been trying to drop a few pounds before prom. But before I could apologize, she hauled off and backhanded me as hard as she could in my left breast. It hurt so much that tears immediately filled my eyes, and I remember thinking that a blow to a guy's balls couldn't be any more painful. So, of course, I slapped her back, and within seconds, a wild, hair-pulling, name-calling melee ensued in the middle of the Chick-fil-A drive-thru. Of course, I got to school late that morning, disheveled and miserable, and for days afterward, I worried that her blow to my boob might somehow cause breast cancer. A small part of me even hoped for some real damage, if only to reinforce to my parents that I was their nicer, better daughter, and that their middle child might be the most selfish person on the planet. God, that was so redneck, Josie says now, laughing. I know, I say. Total white trash. She continues to smile, but informs me that I've just used a racist expression. How do you figure? I say, weary of her political correctness, which I know she simply parrots from Gabe. Well, why specify white? Name another instance when you actually specify the majority. It just seems to imply that all other races are de facto trash, she says. I roll my eyes and say, that's a bit of a reach, but whatever. We stare at each other an awkward few beats before she slaps her thighs and says, you know what? I think we should go out after all. Is there a low-key spot around here? Of course, I say. We're in the village. It's all low-key. But did you want to talk about Daniel first? Nah, she says, waving me off. We have all weekend. That can wait. At Josie's request for a burger, we decide on the Minetta Tavern for dinner. We have a nice, relaxed time, without so much as a fleeting undercurrent of tension, and an even better time once back at Ellen's. Against all odds, we fall into one of our rare, light-hearted zones, with lots of reminiscing, mostly about our childhood, before our adolescent friction set in. Daniel's name comes up here and there, but only in the context of family lore from before we lost him. As we get in bed and start to fall asleep, it really hits me how much Josie and I have shared over the years. I think of the expression, from the cradle to the grave, and the fact that she is the only person in the world I can say that about. The next morning is equally nice. After sleeping in, we get up, shower, and head to my favorite generic neighborhood diner for breakfast, then walk up Fifth Avenue, all the way to Bendel's, where Josie spends a small fortune on makeup. We leave the store, crossing 57th Street and passing Bergdorf's and the Plaza, before winding our way back into the park. The day is cold but bright and sun-filled, and my heart feels lighter than it has in weeks, maybe months. I almost tell her this as we stop to sit on the bench, but get distracted as we both read the small silver plaque screwed to the back of it. For Caroline, who loved the park, and George, who was always with her. Josie runs her hands across the words and says, wow, what a sweet dedication. I murmur my agreement as we sit, our backs to the inscription. Do you think the kids did it for their parents? I say, hoping that Josie and I are one day that unified, when Mom and Dad are gone, and it truly is just the two of us. Probably, she says with a faint smile. I picture a little old couple who sat right here every morning with their little dog and matching canes until one night they died in their sleep. Together. I nod and smile. That's about as happy an ending as you can get, I say, thinking that even the happiest possible endings still ultimately end in death. I share the observation aloud, and she looks at me and shakes her head. God, Mare, what a downer. I shrug and say, well, it's the truth. I know, but geez. We both laugh, then sit for a stretch of silence before she shoots me a serious glance. So, do you want to talk about what's going on? She asks, her voice soft. With Nolan? For the first time in a long time, I actually want to confide in my sister. so I go with it. I don't think I married the right person, I say, squinting up at the cobalt, cloudless sky and wishing I'd worn my sunglasses. I wait a beat, then meet her gaze. Her expression is more sad than judgmental. The opposite of what I expected. I know, she says, nodding. Nolan sort of told me.
He did?
Yes, don't be mad at him. I shake my head. I'm not. What did he say? She swallows, staring down at her pearly pink manicure. He's scared you want to divorce him. I freeze. That word. Do you? She asks, glancing up from her hands to look at me. I slowly nod and say, I think maybe it's the right decision. But why? She asks, sounding so innocently mournful. He loves you so much. First of all, I don't know that that's true. She cuts me off and says, Oh, Mare, it is true. Don't you see the way he looks at you? He adores you. He respects you. God, you're so lucky. And just like that, I feel my sadness morph into defensiveness and resentment. I'm not lucky, I say. I married someone I was never really in love with. I cried on my wedding day. That's not lucky. That's just lame. I look at my sister, unsure of whether I want her to argue or relent the point. But you have a good marriage, she says. Don't you? In some ways, I reply. Okay, in a lot of ways, maybe, but sometimes I want more. For both of us. I want both of us to have the real deal. What Daniel had with Sophie. I know, she says softly. I use them as a benchmark, too. You do? I say. I thought you used Will for that. She nods. Yeah, for a while I did. I wanted Will to be my Sophie. On paper, he seemed to be, but looking back, he wasn't. She gives me a funny look, then says, Speaking of, she actually wants to have dinner with us tonight. Sophie? I say, thinking I must be confused. Yeah, I got in touch with her the other day, on Facebook. I told her we were going to be in town and gave her my phone number. She texted last night and said she'd love to meet us for dinner. She texted you last night? I say, my voice rising. And you're just mentioning it to me now? Yeah. I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. I close my eyes, shake my head, and say her name under my breath. What? I thought you wanted to see her, she says, her voice now raised and whiny. How could you possibly be upset with me for arranging something that you and Mom wanted in the first place? Well, for one, I say, Mom's not here. I know, but we can always see Sophie again in December, with Mom. So we wait 15 years and then we see her twice in a matter of weeks? Well, why not? Doesn't that seem a bit excessive? Sorry, I didn't check the etiquette guide on this topic. She pulls her phone out of her purse and mumbles that she'll just text her back that we can't make it. I exhale with disgust, then reach out and put my hand on her forearm. Stop. Don't text her that. That's rude. I just need to think for a second. About what? About whether I'm up for seeing Sophie tonight with absolutely no warning whatsoever. Why do you need warning, she says. I mean, what's the difference? Now or next month? I just wish we had discussed it together. That's what we're doing now, she says. Isn't it? Yes, but... But what? Why does everything have to be exactly on your terms? It doesn't, I say, thinking of how many times she's called me a control freak for simply having an opinion that differs from hers. I just... You just what, Meredith? Why are you always so dissatisfied with me? She stands and looks down at me, her hands shoved into her pockets. I'm not, I lie. Yes, you are, and so are Mom and Dad. God, I'm sorry I'm not perfect like you and Daniel, she says, stalking away from me. I get up and quickly catch up to her. Could you stop it with the pity party? She stops and glowers at me. It's not a pity party at all, she says. I'm just sick and tired of your constant judgment. I'm here this weekend to talk about Daniel. That's why I reached out to Sophie. I'm trying to do the right thing here. Can't you see that? I stare at her, fleetingly seeing things her way. But like Reuben's famous optical illusion, I quickly return to my view. That white vase so much more obvious than the dual black profiles. Okay, I say, giving in. Text her back. Tell her we'll meet her for dinner. Is that what you really want? She asks, as it occurs to me that she could be calling my bluff, hoping that I'm the one who will decide against seeing Sophie. Instead, I give her a breezy shrug. Sure, I say. Let's do it.
Chapter 27, Josie. I should have known Meredith would find a way to be pissed off at me for contacting Sophie. It had actually crossed my mind to vet it with her first, but then I thought, no, I should just be proactive, handle something on my own for once. Besides, I really didn't expect Sophie to reply so quickly. I thought there was a very good chance she wouldn't respond until next week, which would mean I'd get credit with Mom and Mare for reaching out to her without actually having to endure yet another emotional encounter. Then, last night, when I got Sophie's response, I didn't want to bring up anything heavy when Meredith and I were having such a good time, joking and laughing and bonding. It felt so nice and natural, the way I see so many other sisters getting along. I just wanted to savor it, especially given the dread I felt over my impending confession and the very real possibility that Meredith will never forgive me for my role in Daniel's accident. But of course, my strategy backfired. And as we walk through the park, I watch her do a complete 180, her mood going from cheerful to dour in record time.
All right, she briskly announces. I'm ready to head home.
Now? I say, thinking that I wanted to shop a bit more on the way back.
Yeah, but you don't have to come with me, she says, slipping into full-on passive-aggressiveness. You know your way.
I shake my head, knowing she will only hold that against me, too, and can practically script her rant.
How can you go shopping at a time like this?
And really, she'd be right. That magical Manhattan feeling quickly dissipates as I process that I now have not one, but two big things to dread. No, I'll go back with you, I insist. She nods, quickening her pace as we head west through the park, the opposite direction from which we came. Why are we going this way? I ask, practically jogging to keep up.
This is the way to the subway.
Oh, you don't want to walk back?
No, I want to take the subway.
Well, alrighty then, I mumble. A silent, sullen 15-minute journey later, we enter the subway station at 57th and 7th, dipping underground, then standing in more silence on the dank platform. Look, I finally say, mouth-breathing to avoid the stench of urine and garbage. We really don't have to see Sophie tonight. We can tell her we have plans. We can tell her we'll do it another time.
No, it's fine, she says,
which with Meredith means it's not fine, but she's going to play the martyr.
So you want to go? I confirm. I said yes, it's fine.
I look at her, frustration welling inside me. I just don't see why you're so mad at me, I say as a train roars toward us.
I'm not mad, she shouts back at me over the vibrating clamor of metal on metal.
Okay, what are you then? I ask as the train screeches to a halt and we board a mostly empty car. She waits for me to sit, then chooses a seat diagonally across from me. What are you then? I repeat.
When she still doesn't answer, I offer her a multiple choice. Upset? Annoyed? Frustrated? All of the above, she says, crossing her arms tightly over her chest. Why? I say, genuinely wanting to know. I just don't see why. Well, for starters, let's back up here. I've been trying to get you to go to the cemetery forever. Mom, too. And you finally go when I'm out of town, and you don't even tell Mom you're going? It was a last-minute thing, I tell her. But that's even worse, she says. You go on a whim? Without us? I let out a weary sigh, then try to explain. I was at your house, spending time with your daughter, because your husband lost Rabbi.
So?
She says. And your point is? My point is, it just came up. Nolan asked me to go with him. I wanted to say no, but I felt sorry for him, you know, with everything going on. So I said yes. How can you be pissed at me for that? Meredith doesn't answer the question, just stares at me, then presses on to her next point. Second of all, I specifically told you that Mom and I wanted to plan something for this December, for the 15-year anniversary. I once again wince at her use of anniversary in this context. And then you pull this stunt, she says. This was supposed to be about you and me and Mom doing something together, in Daniel's memory. Well, we're together now, I say. I know, but Mom's not here. And shit, Josie, she says, throwing her hands up, then letting them fall back onto her lap. Don't you get my point at all? That we always do things your way, on your terms? Yes, I get that it might seem like that, but things change. Neither one of us thought you were going to take a leave from work and flee to New York and plan a divorce. Can we please leave Nolan and my marriage out of this? Fine, I say, catching an older woman staring at us. I slide down a couple feet, so I'm directly across from Meredith, then lean forward, lowering my voice. But I think it's all related. She shakes her head and says, No, it's not all related. Yes, it is, I insist, my heart now racing. It all goes back to Daniel. Don't you see that? Nolan, your marriage, Sophie. I nearly blurt out my confession right there on the subway, just to get it over with and win the debate. Show her just how much it's all so fucking interrelated. But she is now glaring at me with such animosity that I back down, afraid. My issues too, I simply say. And I really want to sort those things out before I have a baby, before I become a mother. Exactly, she says, raising her voice and pointing at me, just like the lawyer that she is. I stare back at her, wondering what point she thinks I've just made for her. What? I say. Is there something wrong with that? God, Mare, why do you hate me so much? I don't hate you, she says, giving me a look like she does. I'm just sick and tired of everything revolving around you. Your timing, your plans. It's always about you, Josie. My cheeks on fire, I say. That's so unfair. I came here to see you, Meredith, and to make sure you're okay. I was really hoping to work on our relationship, which is why I didn't want to spoil our good mood last night with anything serious. She starts to speak, but I hold my hand in the air, determined to make my last point. And I also came here because I need to talk to you about Daniel. Yeah, you keep saying that, she says, shaking her head. When's that conversation going to happen anyway? Tonight, I say, knowing that things are about to get much, much worse between my sister and me. When we get back to Ellen's, I text Sophie, telling her that we would love to meet up with her tonight. She quickly writes back, suggesting we come to her place on the Upper West Side for a drink before dinner, and she'll make a reservation somewhere casual. In the hours that follow, Meredith and I both react to the stress of our plan in our typical ways. She changes into workout clothes and announces that she's going for a long run. I change into sweats, crawl back into bed, and fall into a deep sleep. I awaken sometime later to my vibrating phone, feeling disoriented, and even more so when I see Pete's name. I suddenly remember where I am as I answer with a groggy hello.
"Hi, you," he says, his voice chipper. "Were you asleep?"
"No," I fib, wondering why I always deny being asleep or drunk. He asks me what's going on, and I tell him I'm in New York, visiting my sister. I haven't spoken to him in a few days, and have yet to tell him about my decision to use Gabe as my donor. I feel bad, having gone so far down this path with Pete, especially given his generosity throughout. I don't want to hurt his feelings or seem mere curial, but these factors just can't override the bigger picture. Contrary to what Meredith might think, I have no illusions about how serious this undertaking is, that we are talking about a child's life here. Anyway, Pete might even be relieved to be off the hook. Surely he's had his share of doubts and second thoughts, too. But at the same time, I'm more than a little worried that it will extinguish any romantic possibility between us, and maybe even end our odd, fledgling friendship. And I have the sad, sinking feeling that I'm really going to miss him.
"Oh, cool," he says. "I didn't know you were going up there."
"Yeah, it was kind of last minute. My sister and I really needed to sort some things out," I say, as it actually crosses my mind to tell him everything. As in, everything. Instead, I stick to the broad strokes about Sophie and our plan to see her this evening. "It'll be the first time we've seen her since my brother's funeral," I say. Pete whistles.
"Wow, that sounds intense."
"Yeah, it's probably going to be pretty awkward." My voice trails off.
"Is she married?"
I tell him I don't know, that her Facebook page is vague. She mostly posts articles or random funny Seinfeld-esque observations. "It looks like she has a son," I add. "There's one little boy on there a lot. But I guess it could be her nephew or a family friend. You know, like you and Fudge."
"Right," he says with a laugh. "Good old Fudge."
"So anyway, what's going on with you?" I ask, mentally refuting Meredith's accusation that I'm self-absorbed.
"Not much," Pete says. "I was just kind of missing you."
I smile, pleasantly surprised by his answer.
"Really?"
"Yeah," Pete says. "I mean, not a lot, but a little."
"A little, huh?"
"Yeah, a smidge."
"Well, I miss you a smidge, too," I say, as I get an unexpected tingly feeling.
"Well, good," he says. "So when are you coming home?"
"Tomorrow," I say. "My flight lands around 5, I think."
"You need a lift home?" he asks. "I'd be happy to come get you."
"Aw, thanks," I say. "That's really sweet, but I drove."
"Well then, how about dinner? Monday night?"
"That'd be great. I actually wanted to talk to you about something."
"Oh?"
he says, his tone turning serious.
"About?"
"Just some things," I say.
"You mean baby daddy stuff, or our kiss at Johnny's?"
I laugh, remembering the feel of his lips on mine. "Both, actually," I say. 2 hours later, Meredith and I are cabbing it to the Upper West Side. I feel queasy for the obvious reasons, but also a little intimidated by the idea of dining with an accomplished, sophisticated British doctor. I can tell Meredith is uneasy, too, as she keeps checking her makeup and fiddling with her hair. "You look great," I say, glancing at her sideways. Looking sheepish for being caught primping, she snaps her compact closed and stows it back in her purse, murmuring a dismissive thanks. "At least there are two of us. There's only one of her. I bet she's more nervous than we are," I muse aloud.
"I'm not nervous," she quickly says.
I shoot her a skeptical look and say, "Come on, Mare, how could you not be nervous?"
"I'm just not," she insists. "I'm a little apprehensive, maybe. I mean, she's sort of a stranger."
"She's completely a stranger. We haven't laid eyes on her since Daniel's funeral. I don't even think I talked to her that day."
"You didn't talk to anyone that day," Meredith says with an accusatorial edge.
I ignore the dig and ask her if we should have a signal.
"A A signal for what?
A signal for let's get the hell out of here. Meredith purses her lips and shakes her head adamant.
No, no signals. We have to be warm and engaging no matter what. We have to make a good impression. For Daniel, you know?
It occurs to me to accuse her of being too wrapped up in appearances, which she is, or to point out that if Daniel really is up there watching us, our making a good impression on Sophie surely would be among the least of his concerns. But the last thing we need right now is another tiff, so I simply say, yeah, I guess so. A few minutes later, we arrive at Sophie's building on Central Park West. Meredith and I get out of the cab and walk into the marble lobby of a stuffy doorman building.
Moving on up.
I start singing the theme from the Jeffersons, mesmerized by a big crystal chandelier. Meredith hisses at me to stop it as the doorman smiles, then asks if he may help us.
Yes, she replies, her voice high and prim. Could you please tell Sophie Mitchell that Meredith and Josie are here to see her?
He nods briskly, picks up an old-fashioned telephone, and says,
Yes, hello, Dr. Mitchell. Meredith and Josie are here. Very well. Will do.
He hangs up, points to the elevator, and says,
9th floor.
Mare thanks him, and we head that way. Once inside the elevator, we wait for both sets of doors to close, the outer, then the inner accordion-like grate, before lurching upward. After a slow ascent, we grind to a stop, and the doors open in reverse order into a small vestibule flanked by 2 apartments. Before we can select the correct door, one swings open, and there stands a surprisingly faded version of Daniel Sophie. I'd still characterize her as attractive, in a Euro sort of way, and she is wearing a very chic jumpsuit and pointed patent flats, but she has a less than svelte figure and heavily sunspotted skin.
Hello, come in,
she says, her voice exactly as I remembered, her English accent undiluted by so many years in the States. I can tell she's nervous as she steps forward to give us each a stiff, arm's-length hug in our birth order.
It's so nice to see you both again.
It's nice to see you too, Meredith says.
Yes, thank you for having us over, I add as Sophie leads us into her living room. I note that there are about a dozen places to sit, including an L-shaped sectional, 2 huge armchairs, and several plush ottomans, yet no television in sight. I have a sudden random recollection of her telling us that she wasn't allowed to watch it growing up.
You have a beautiful home, Meredith says.
Thank you, Sophie says. We just completed a renovation. This used to be the dining room, but nobody entertains that way anymore. She laughs, then adds, and I still can't cook.
I catch the we, and feel sure Meredith does too, yet still see no signs of a husband, or a child for that matter, though I do see several framed photos of the boy from her Facebook page. We follow Sophie into her all-white contemporary kitchen, as she asks what we'd like to drink.
A cocktail, or a glass of wine?
Meredith and I both say sure, we would love a glass of wine.
Red or white, she asks.
Whatever you have open, Meredith says, until Sophie insists that we choose.
Red would be great, thanks, I finally decide when I notice that Sophie is drinking red.
Her stemless lipstick-stained glass rests on the counter next to an artfully arranged charcuterie board. She may not be able to cook, but she certainly can entertain.
And for you, Meredith, Sophie asks with a charming lilt.
Red would be lovely, my sister says, sounding pretentious.
Sophie reaches up, plucking 2 glasses from her open shelving, then fills them both a little more than halfway. Meredith and I each take one as Sophie lifts hers, a smile frozen on her face. An awkward beat follows as it becomes clear that she is poised to make a toast.
To old acquaintances, she finally says, looking into my eyes, then Meredith's.
To old acquaintances, we echo. I force a smile as I think of how contradictory the 2 words are. Acquaintances always seeming as if they should be brand new, either progressing to full-on friendship or falling back into obscurity. Then again, I can't think of a more accurate categorization. So I give her a pass as we all sip our wine. An awkward lull follows. Sophie speaking first.